Hello and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week we go from one of the most expensive films ever made to one of the cheapest. I review Spider-Man 3, budget $250 million, and interview Lorraine Stanley, the star of London to Brighton, budget 80,000 quid. The best British film of last year, now out on DVD. We've also got Oscar-nominated British director Mike Figgis for you, a man who's handled budgets from Hollywood to homemade and is now the author of a new book on making your own digital movies. I'm Jason Solomons, and you're listening to Film Weekly. Look out, here comes another Spider-Man movie. The third in the franchise has been touted as the most costly film ever, a title that now seems to change hands every year. Peter Jackson's King Kong was the previous record holder at $207 million. And I must say that of all the CGI-dominated summer blockbuster superhero-type films, Spidey is the only one I actually look forward to with some kind of interest. Much of this has to do with the thoughtful approach of actor Tobey Maguire, whose Peter Parker character is so geeky he actually looks like Mr. Bean futting along on his scooter at the beginning of this film. Things are going well for Peter and for Spidey. Kirsten Dunst's Mary Jane, now fully aware of Peter's alter superego, is beginning her career on Broadway, with Peter adoringly mouthing along in the front row, plucking up the courage to propose. Reflecting Peter's inner peace, the city of New York, a major character in these films, is also experiencing a period of Spidey-protected calm and prosperity. But the idyll cannot last. Henry, son of the Green Goblin, is out to win MJ's heart. Flint Marko, who killed Uncle Ben, escapes from prison and stumbles into a nuclear plant to become the Sandman. There's an ambitious and unscrupulous new photographer after Peter's job at the Bugle, and a bit of black slime has landed from a meteorite and attached itself to Peter's skin. For its first hour, this Spidey is one of the finest superhero movies ever. The money's up there on the screen, combined with wit and flair. A particularly fine aerial fight between Spider-Man and the young Goblin shows off the film's essential clashes between good and evil, love and lust, set among New York's vertiginous concrete peaks and valleys. The scenes at the newspaper office are also funny, while a prize-giving ceremony giving Spidey the keys to the city is imaginatively staged, even featuring a brass band playing that cartoon theme tune. Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood, one of my favourite lyrics of all time. The creation of Sandman is also beautifully realised. While the combination of sentimentality with trinkets and lockets and engagement rings and the nostalgia has a quaintly 50s ring to it, complete with damsels in distress and girls in tight jumpers. In all honesty, I was loving it.
Hello, I'm Gwen Stacy.
This is Mary Jane Watson.
Oh, it's so nice to finally meet you. Pete talks about you all the time. Oh?
Gwen is my lab partner in Dr. Connor's class.
Pete's something of a genius. I'd be completely lost without him. Which actually reminds me, Pete, if you've got a picture of my kiss with Spider-Man, could you bring it to class? I'd really love it. For my portfolio. After all, who gets kissed by Spider-Man, right? I can't imagine. Well, it was lovely to meet you. Good night.
Good night.
But then Sam Raimi gets stuck in the web of his own plot. Suddenly, Spidey turns to the dark side through the unexplained presence of this alien slime that turns his heart and his costume black. Then the Sandman teams up with a dodgy new snapper to turn the city upside down, while MJ mopes at her bad reviews and nags her man for not paying her enough attention. The film drags on and on, threatening to end but never quite managing it, until many in the audience were huffing and tutting at the sheer narrative incohesion of things. In one cute early sequence, there's a little kid who goes yuck when Spidey kisses a girl, and that's how I felt when the film becomes a tedious love story later on. Dunst is simply not interesting enough to sustain momentum here, and while Raimi tries to cram in themes of moral choices and personal growth, you get the feeling that this big screen franchise and this superhero have now run out of things to say. So, when you've got $250 million, you can order rewrites and reshoots, although you can bet these days when the studios divvy up their budgets, the tiniest proportion ends up being spent on the script. In what couldn't be a handier contrast, this week sees the arrival on DVD of London to Brighton, a rock-hard, get it? See what I've done there? Brighton, rock, underworld thriller written and directed last year by Paul Andrew Williams on a budget of around £60,000. It tells the story of a young runaway girl taken under the wing of a street-hardened prostitute after a job with a seedy but wealthy gangland boss goes badly wrong. The unlikely pair are chased down to the seaside by a desperate pimp who, in turn, is being chased by the crime lord's vengeful son. The film is lean, mean and brutal, but shot through with human kindness and touches of tragedy. The performances, dialogue and look are classic British all the way, recalling the grim, dimly lit days of Get Carter, Performance and Croupier, rather than the larks of Lockstock. Despite critical acclaim, the film hardly made a dent at the box office on release last year, but now it's out on DVD, we at Film Weekly hope to help boost its cult status. And we're delighted to welcome to our sumptuous studio its star, Lorraine Stanley, who plays the black-eyed prostitute, Kelly.
Hello.
Lovely to see you. Congratulations on, I know it's 6 months ago, what was a fantastic role for you. I've just seen it again on DVD. It just looks so good, this film, still. I think it's got this classic status already.
Yeah, I don't really know what to say about that, but yeah, it has. And I hope it does. Even better on DVD, which I think it will.
Yeah, because there was this problem. A lot of people wanted to see it. It had great critical acclaim and we were trying to support it everywhere we could. But still, a lot of people had trouble trying to find it at the cinema.
Yeah, I think because it was in like all the art house cinemas. But I think now it's on DVD, it's a chance for sort of people to see it.
It's funny that it does come out in this week opposite Spider-Man, you know, one of the most expensive films ever made. It's what surely must be one of the cheapest. I mean, I remember you and Paul Andrew Williams telling me at the time it was about $60,000 you managed to cobble together, and then you got a few more quid just to get the posters made.
Yeah.
What's it like working on such a tight budget?
Well, I got the bus to film set sometimes. I had to drive a lot myself. We were given sort of hot dogs and sort of crappy food to eat. But it sort of added to the film, I think. Had we a lot of money to make it, I don't think it would have been half as good.
Yeah, I saw Kirsten Dunst on the number 19 the other week.
Oh, really? Well, she's not as stunning as me. She may have more money, but I'll tell you what.
But I think that it kind of focuses you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you've got so few days of shooting, you've got to get it all done. Was there a sense of this tremendous momentum that it had built up?
Yeah, we were sort of, I think we had 19 days to do it, and some of it was really rushed. But I think overall, it helped us, because of the sort of film it was, I think it helped us that we had no money, because it was sort of living, not like living as a prostitute, but it was like living rough. You know, some of the places and venues we were at were rough.
Yeah, I mean, from the very first scene in the loo in the station, yeah. I mean, it kind of reeks, this film. You can taste the crappy ketchup, the bad chips.
Yeah. It was true to life. The toilets was actually a geezer's toilet, so it stunk, by the way, and it was at the top.
Oh, because
of
the
pub.
Women's ones are also fragrant.
They smell of roses. Yes. No, the toilet stunk. It was above a pub. And the chips that Georgia was eating in that cafe, they were rank. Me and Johnny were, like, laughing a lot when she was eating it, because they were disgusting.
I have to get the train. Go somewhere. We ain't safe here. I've got a mate in Brighton. He don't know where. We'll go there for a bit.
What about that man there?
Shut up. Don't worry. He ain't going to find us. Look, you're going to have to stay here. You're going to have to stay here in the cubicle. I've got to go and get some money so we can get the train.
What about my money?
Later. Can you stay here?
For how long?
An hour? Hour and a half?
I don't want to be on my own.
I know, but you can't come with me. Look, just wait here. I won't be long, all right?
So the grotty situations, did they kind of help you read your character? You could kind of take your character from the dirt on the floor, if you like, an extension,
yeah,
if you like.
Definitely. The scene helped that we were in some grotty locations. My eye was, you know, out here somewhere. And yeah, I think I just played it, what if I was in this situation?
Was there an end of filming every day, or was the crew always very tight together? Did you all stay in the same places, or could you go home at the end of the day and kind of find your normal Lorraine?
Yeah, we went home most days, apart from when we were in Brighton and we were sort of all in the hotel and we had a good night out, which we probably shouldn't have done. But no, other than that, I went home every day and sort of, yeah, I don't take the character home with me. Once it's done and they cut it, I'm back to my stupid self.
Because she's a great character. I think that the classic tart with a heart in a way,
yeah.
But except she doesn't really have that much heart. I think the end of the film is so exciting because you just don't know if Kelly's going back to just another day on the streets or if she's kind of been changed by this experience, which I think is one of the great kind of open-ended film endings. Where do you take this character?
When she's walking off in that moment, she is, you know, she's going to look for another punter because that's how she needs to get her next bit of money. But I think the whole drama of what's happened to her will affect her situation, and she probably will sort it out and maybe get a little job. She hasn't got Derek anymore. So I think it will shape her.
The relationship between you and Georgia, the little runaway girl, you kind of take under your wing,
yeah,
is very tender, but only in moments. Particularly, I'm thinking of the great scene in the arcade where she's trying to pick up the teddy bear, which I think is really poignant because it's just like it's just out of her reach. It keeps slipping out of her grasp. Was that written as it was, or did you two play your relationship off each other?
I think most of it was written. We did improvise some stuff, but most of it was written. But I think we naturally formed a bond whilst filming. I hadn't really met her. I'd met her once. So I think it was a natural process of our characters meeting. By the time we were in Brighton, we sort of filmed it almost in order. So by that point, we had bonded. Do you know what I mean? So that's probably why it's so real. We had a lot of humour. We laughed a lot. We had to, just to get through it.
I suppose she didn't go out at nights with a lot of you.
Well, she did, actually. Did she? Yeah. Not like, obviously, out till late. But yeah, her and her mum used to come out with us, and we sort of all had a good giggle in Brighton.
The fear that is in the film that runs all the way through it, that you've got, that George has got, that Johnny Harris has got, everyone has kind of got this kind of passed on fear. Everyone's in this kind of cold sweat. And I think that the audience experiences that too.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's done a lot with the way the cameras, the way it's filmed, sort of, so the audience feel that they're actually with these characters.
Did you... So just tell me what it's like, the camera that Paul Andrew Williams was using, the director, that the situations, was it very handheld? How many sort of people were there on the set at any particular time? Was it all squeezing into a toilet cubicle?
Yeah, it was. Chris was absolutely brilliant. Sometimes he'd be lying on the floor. Literally, a lot of it was handheld. And he was just so passionate and dedicated to the job that I think it really shows in the film.
Now, just tell me, because when you were on the awards circuit last year, from the British Independent Film Awards to the BAFTAs, I mean, that must have been a complete thrill for a film that you knew was so cheap, and you could never have imagined it, surely, going that far.
No, never. God, I couldn't believe it. And to be nominated for Best Actress at the Critics Awards, wow, chuffed. Got to wear the dress.
You nearly won, you know that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you were very close.
Helen Mirren, damn.
If it wasn't for that queen.
Yeah. No, it was just nice to be there. And
did you meet her?
I did. I spoke to her and she thought I was wonderful. And Charles Dance was there, who I missed at Dinard, and he was praising me, which was nice. Yeah, I was really chuffed.
Because I remember you telling me during that period that you weren't working as an actress still. You were a waitress still.
Yeah, I'm still a waitress now.
Yeah. So have you had any offers off the back of London to Brighton?
I've done a few TV jobs, but no, not yet.
So you're still waiting for Sam Raimi and Spider-Man 4?
Yes. Oh, wouldn't that be brilliant? Yeah, I won't have to waitress anymore. If all else fails, Lorraine does Dallas. I'm sorry.
Lorraine doing London and Brighton was brilliant enough. Congratulations on the film. I'm really wishing it the best on DVD and hopefully the best for you, because I think it's a sterling performance, a fantastic performance from everyone involved, but particularly
everyone.
For you. And really glad you could come on Film Weekly today.
Thank you very much.
And Lorraine Stanley from London to Brighton has kindly left with us one copy of London to Brighton on DVD, the sole remaining copy, the golden ticket, which we offer up as our prize to you this week. All you've got to do is tell me which is the greatest British gangster film of all time. In the style of The Player, we demand your explanation in 25 words or less. The greatest British gangster film of all time. Send your answers to podcasts@observer.co.uk. That's podcasts@observer.co.uk. The winner will get half a pint of mild, a cigar in the eye, a Sam Markle suit, dinner with Bob Hoskins down the Blind Beggar, a knuckle sandwich, a shooter, claret all over his whistle, and a copy of London to Brighton on DVD. Coming up later on Film Weekly, we talk to Mike Figgis about how to make your own low-budget digital movies. But first, it's time for the rest of the week's releases. The Upside of Anger is a family saga with a terrific cast and a dullish script. Joan Allen is the mater familias nudged into drunken misery by the disappearance of her husband. She's left with the comfort of her teenage daughters, Erica Christensen, Alicia Witt, and Evan Rachel Wood, and a washed-up former baseball star turned radio jockey, Kevin Costner. The girls are forever making dinner and worrying about boyfriends, while writer-director Mike Binder, who also wrote and directed the recent Rain Over Me with Adam Sandler, pops up as a CD radio producer with designs on Erica Christensen's talents. This is a comfy comedy about growing old and growing up, peppered with lovely moments and endearing performances, yes, even from Costner, but it has all the excitement of an old jumper. Dans Paris, or Inside Paris, is a new film from highly touted French director Christophe Honoré, starring two of the hottest Gallic acting talents around, Romain Duris and Louis Garrel, as brothers helping each other through various problems with women. This is French as you like. Girls wander around with their pert little breasts, smoking and wearing their knickers, while jazz plays in the background and characters talk of love, death and sex. There are jazzy jump cut sequences by Paris landmarks and angsty boys contemplate suicide while a grumpy old dad, Truffaut regular Guy Marchand, smokes non-stop and tries to cook. It could have worked, but it doesn't, and the result is a humourless romp through clichés and empty homage. Richard Linklater made a surprisingly beautiful Parisian love film in Before Sunrise not so long ago. His latest film is a definite change of pace and setting as Fast Food Nation adapts Eric Schlosser's campaigning book into a preachy, well-meant film about how bad burgers are for you.
Welcome to Mickey's. Can I take your order?
Yeah, I'm thinking about
a big one.
Okay, would you like some large fries with that?
No, thanks. Not tonight.
Our super value drink?
I'll have a chocolate shake and a water.
All right. Would you like any dessert with that? A brownie pie or a turnover?
No, not tonight.
Okay. That'll be $4.98.
Okay. What's your favorite thing on the menu?
I like everything.
Well, I know that's not true. But you did give me the correct answer. I was just testing you. I'm actually a vice president of marketing for Mickey's.
Really?
Yeah, it's true. Just here in town for a couple of days, seeing where the big ones come from.
Here?
Oh, no, not here, but at Uniqlo Meatpacking just outside of town. That's where every single big one patty in the entire country gets made.
No way.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Greg Kinnear plays a marketing exec at Mickey's Burger Chain, sent to a vast meat plant in Colorado to find out why the patties have a high content of shit in them. Linklater tries to encompass all society in a burger, the illegal Mexicans working in slave conditions at the plant, the corporate cover-ups, the conspiracies to buy land, the earnest students, including Avril Lavigne, who try to free the cows. The star cast brings its own iconography. Catalina Sandino Moreno was the Latin victim of the drugs trade in Maria Full of Grace, and she's now emblematic of American exploitation of Mexican labour. The presence of Kris Kristofferson's wizened cowboy recalls the socio-political works of John Sayles, while Luis Guzman's nocturnal border crossings recall Steven Soderbergh's Traffic. While the film is always engaging, it does lack subtlety and any real drama, lumbered with a leaden script and a wearying, holier-than-thou attitude which might work on young American undergraduates, but which never finds real political or satirical focus. Although the images of cows being slaughtered are pretty gruesome, they're unlikely to turn anyone off burgers who isn't off them already. Indeed, the film's co-producer is one Malcolm McLaren, whose Buffalo Girls have long been going round the outside. Director Mike Figgis is one of Britain's most maverick and unpredictable talents. He first hit the scene with Stormy Monday back in the late 80s before going to Hollywood to have success with films such as Leaving Las Vegas and Internal Affairs. His recent experiments have led him down a digital route through films such as Hotel and Time Code and have led him now to become the author of a new book about digital movie making. I met up with Mike Figgis and asked him why he's been taken with a professorial bug.
Well, I've always been a passer on because I remembered that when I, you know, first started trying to make films or anything, actually, there was always this kind of attitude of that's for me to know and you to guess or to find out, Sonny, you know, when you're a grown up. you know, the film business seemed to be have this sort of protective wall around it, which was that knowledge was power, and that was knowledge was something you required painfully, you know, through working your way up through the, you know, painfully through the sort of stepladders. And so my friend Walter Donahue from Fabers, probably 4 years ago, if I'm honest, sort of said, you know, you should do a book just about low budget, at that point low budget filmmaking, not even digital, you know. And I agreed to do it, and years passed, and he kept saying, you know, eventually he said, look, I'm coming around on Tuesday with a tape recorder. We have to do this book because they've already done the cover, you know, and you've signed a contract. So that's how it happened. And then literally we just made some headlines about, you know, what are the obvious processes of filmmaking? Well, there's writing the script, there's pre-production, there's finding a location, there's casting the actors, and there's the bit where you actually shoot it and all the problems that could occur there. And then there's post-production and there's music. And then there's distribution. And why don't we just go through all of those categories and talk your way through what you consider to be the problems and how you might solve those problems.
I mean, you say that those are all the problems of a filmmaker, and you've had your difficulties looking at the book with, you know, each step in that process. You seem to be still fascinated by the entire process.
Yeah, because it is a process. I mean, filmmaking is very complicated in the sense that you have to use other people, even if you're making a low, low, low. I mean, I've made films, I suppose, the smallest crew I've ever had would be, well, just me and one assistant, let's say. And I could theoretically do it, but I have made films entirely by myself. You know, that means you have to spend a couple of hours preparing all the equipment so that when it comes to do it, all you have to do is turn on buttons and you made sure all the batteries are charged and all that sort of stuff. I'd rather not do that. I'd rather have a small team with me and say, have you charged the batteries? Yeah, of course we've done it, and blah, blah, blah. The process, whether it's 100 people or 5 people, it's still a process, and it still requires planning. So it's all about planning. Actually, maybe the book is all about, you know, thinking ahead, this might go wrong. If this goes wrong, what are you going to do about it? What if it's raining?
These seem very unattractive, though. You know, when a film's such almost a glamour business, and indeed the process of creation, people say, I want to make a film, it's because they want to bring a story to the screen or work with a certain actor. They don't really think that, oh God, I've got to think about location and catering and what if it's raining and all these kind of contingency plans. Mm-hmm. I mean, reading the book, you've made it sound very interesting, but there is this kind of nitty-gritty.
Yeah, it is about nitty-gritty. And I, you know, my observation has been, you know, like, a student will come up to you and say, oh, you know, if you ever need a runner or something like that, I would work for nothing. I just want to watch you working. And a couple of times, you know, if there's been the opportunity, I bring people on like that. And you notice after 2 days, they are bored rigid. They would rather be, you know, watching paint dry than being on a film set, because they suddenly realize that it's, you know, you do a scene and it's quite interesting, and they kind of go, oh, what's next? Well, what's next is we do that same scene for the next 4 hours. And we cover it, and we try and keep it fresh so it doesn't seem like we're just repeating ourselves.
Are you putting people off, or are you turning people on?
It's better to be realistic. You know, if you've got an unrealistic idea of what a film, to make a film, what that process is, you're not going to make it through the film. If you know, put it another way, if you're capable of suspending your, as if you like, your disbelief on a large scale so that you understand that to make a film, it's like building, you know, a skyscraper. You have an exciting moment where you design it and it looks great on the page. You have a boring bit where you go and try and raise the money. Then you have a boring bit where you modify your drawing because you haven't got enough money to carry out your vision. Then you have a really boring bit where people come and knock down the existing building and dig a hole. And then the cement mixers turn up and it doesn't look like, it looks like shit. It just doesn't look like anything. And then finally, you know, a year later, they start putting the glass in the windows and they paint it. And you kind of go, oh, it still looks a bit like my drawing, you know. And if you are able to actually have that long-term vision, which means in the bit in between, which is the nitty-gritty, you know, forget the glamour, forget all of that stuff. If you really just have a strong enough belief that if we stick to this plan more or less, the result could be really good. It could be a really good film. But that's the reality of filmmaking. It's not glamorous. It's really hard work, and it's about having the sustainability to see your vision through and not lose the plot.
It strikes me that one of the aspects of the book that I really enjoyed, apart from the sort of technical, is that you've kind of interlaced it with memoirs of your own career quite freely and honestly. It seems, you know, when you were working with, you know, in Hollywood and when you've been back here. And I just want to go back to that time. We're sitting here at in the green room at the National Film Theatre of BFI Suspect, and there's Elizabeth Shue's cleavage and Nicolas Cage's face staring at us because Leaving Las Vegas is on permanent display here. And it seems that early on you had this great kind of Hollywood moments with Leaving Las Vegas and Internal Affairs, that you've now decided that was too much professionalism, too much studio polish, if you like, and you've decreased in your technology.
No, I mean, the contrary is true, because the two films you just mentioned, Leaving Las Vegas and Internal Affairs, were both films that got under the Hollywood radar. Internal Affairs was a low-budget, off-studio, basically Frank Mancuso Jr., who produced it, was the son of Frank Mancuso Sr., who ran Paramount. And Jr. had produced Friday the 13th, parts 1 to 25 or something, made a bucket load of money, and got this script by Henry Bean, you know, who's a really good writer. And I read the script and really went in and fought hard to get, you know, so it was low budget, so I actually won that first battle. And the studio didn't interfere at all because we were under the radar. We weren't a big film. Then the film tested really well, and then they suddenly focused on it, and then Richard Gere's career got revived and so on and so forth. But the film was colossally naive. I'd never been to Los Angeles before. I'd seen a lot of films about Los Angeles, so I shot it based on my sort of film knowledge of LA, and I knew no fear, and I knew no boundaries. I didn't really know how to make proper films, so I just went in, and the result was it's quite good. Leaving Las Vegas had not one cent of American money put into it until MGM bought it for distribution. I had the amazing good fortune to be turned down by Harvey Weinstein and Miramax, who almost bought it, but so lowballed their offer that it wasn't worth it. And I shudder to think what would have happened if Miramax had released the film. You know, they would have changed the score, they would have changed everything. Mm. So by bad good fortune, you know, Leaving Las Vegas, the only mainstream film I've made which was completely interference-free, director's cut, director's music, director's casting choice, you know, is the one that made the most money. And Internal Affairs made, you know, was the next one, I think, that made money.
Yeah.
And the two films that the studio didn't fear in. All the ones where those geniuses stepped in and sort of had their say, all bombed. Mr. Jones, you know, One Night Stand, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, One Night Stand, people are talking about at the moment, it was one of those films that had this social significance. People were talking about the poisonous effect of the One Night Stand. I think Wesley Snipes is fantastic in that film.
Yeah, I mean, I love the film. It bombed. It absolutely bombed. Yeah.
And you still like it?
I don't care if the films bomb or they don't. Mm. I mean, I feel sorry for the people who put the money up. But in the case of New Line, they're not exactly poor. Mm. So, and I think one of the reasons it bombed was that they lost their courage. You know, the film got mixed reviews to such an extent that, you know, Kenneth Turand has said this film is such a stinker that it invites us to look back at Leaving Las Vegas and see that as the overrated piece of work that it really is, you know, which was so deeply, unnecessarily vindictive on his part. And then on the other hand, it got fantastic reviews, you know, and so I went into New Line and said, look, I have a marketing suggestion. On the poster, why don't we put on the left-hand side one-liners from all the bad reviews? And on the right-hand side, one-liners from all the good reviews. And then underneath that, put the critics can't seem to make up their mind. Why don't you make up your own? And they blanched at the idea of putting a negative comment on a poster, you know. And I thought it would have been wonderful, and people would have appreciated it, you know, because it was balanced.
And well, given that it was a film about that debate, and it has black on white sex as well, which so still is extremely rare in mainstream pictures.
But they wouldn't do it, and of course then the film sank without trace, you know.
There are those that would say that the British film industry, ailing slightly, as it always it seems to be.
Are we talking cricket or film?
Yeah, it's too intertwined. Mm. We're not in the World Cup, we're not, and there are no British films in Cannes this year, we find out. There are people that say, well, you know, Mike, you started with Stormy Monday. You're counted as a sort of British filmmaker, and that there were elements of kind of social realism and British film, classic British film traits in that. And then you went off to Hollywood, and we're experimental as you are. We would like to have you back here.
Well, the next film I'm doing is set in Hampstead, and is a sort of, let's say, an erotic thriller, and is contemporary with British actors and maybe a couple of foreign actors or whatever, and is designed to be as potent as possible within a realistic budget constraint, because I want to be able to make the film I want to make. So I'm trying to make it a film that you could make, say, for $1 million. And at this point, I'm not sure whether that's pounds or dollars, but having heard the news yesterday, I realise it's either, if it's pounds, it's $2 million, you know.
No, it's, and which is a lot, but you, that's going to happen, and you think you might get it off ground and start.
I know I will. I mean, and I'm writing that very specifically in terms of, you know, economically what's possible, you know, which to me represents absolutely no limitation on dramatic possibilities of what I might do in the film.
Brilliant. Well, I wish you the best of luck with that. I can't wait to see that.
It's called Suspension of Disbelief, by the way.
It's suspended.
Sod, for short.
Consider it done. Yeah. Mike Figgis, great to see you. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure.
Mike Figgis there, whose new book, Digital Filmmaking, is published by Faber. That's it for another edition of Film Weekly. I've been Jason Solomons. The show has been produced by Paul Noble. And until next week, we wish you happy viewing.